My first really original story idea, you always know the first one, I think, came near the end of Ike's 8-year reign of benignity. I was sitting at the kitchen table of our house in Durham, Maine, and watching my mother stick sheets of S&H green stamps into a book. For more colorful stories about green stamps, see The Liars Club. Mama was about 80 at that time, obese and hypertensive and mostly blind. Daddy Guy was 82, scrawny, morose, and prone to the occasional Donald Duck outburst which only my mother could understand. Mom called Daddy Guy Faza. My mother's sisters had gotten my mom this job, perhaps thinking they could kill two birds with one stone. The aged peas would be taken care of in a homey environment by a loving daughter, and the nagging problem of Ruth would be solved. She would no longer be adrift, trying to take care of two boys while she floated almost aimlessly from Indiana to Wisconsin to Connecticut, baking cookies at 5 in the morning or pressing sheets in a laundry where the temperatures often soared to 110 in the summer, and the foreman gave out salt pills at 1 and 3 every afternoon from July to the end of September. She hated her new job, I think. In their effort to take care of her, her sisters turned our self-sufficient, funny, slightly nutty mother into a sharecropper living a largely cashless existence. The money the sisters sent her each month covered the groceries, but little else. They sent boxes of clothes for us. Toward the end of each summer, Uncle Clay and Aunt Ella, who were not, I think, real relatives at all, would bring cartons of canned vegetables and preserves. The house we lived in belonged to Aunt Ethlyn and Uncle Lauren. And once she was there, Mom was caught. She got another actual job after the old folks died, but she lived in that house until the cancer got her. When she left Durham for the last time, David and his wife Linda cared for her during the final weeks of her final illness. I have an idea she was probably more than ready to go. Let's get one thing clear right now, shall we? There is no idea dump. No story central, no island of the buried bestsellers. Good story ideas seem to come quite literally from nowhere, sailing at you right out of the empty sky. Two previously unrelated ideas come together and make something new under the sun. Your job isn't to find these ideas, but to recognize them when they show up. On the day this particular idea, the first really good one, came sailing at me, my mother remarked that she needed 6 more books of stamps to get a lamp she wanted to give her sister Molly for Christmas, and she didn't think she would make it in time. "I guess it will have to be for her birthday instead," she said. "These cussed things always look like a lot until you stick them in a book." Then she crossed her eyes and ran her tongue out at me. When she did, I saw her tongue was S&H green. I thought how nice it would be if you could make those damn stamps in your basement, and in that instant, a story called Happy Stamps was born. The concept of counterfeiting green stamps and the sight of my mother's green tongue created it in an instant. The hero of my story was your classic poor schmuck, a guy named Roger who had done jail time twice for counterfeiting money. One more bust would make him a 3-time loser. Instead of money, he began to counterfeit happy stamps. Except, he discovered, the design of happy stamps was so moronically simple that he wasn't really counterfeiting at all. He was creating reams of the actual article. In a funny scene, probably the first really competent scene I ever wrote, Roger sits in the living room with his old mom, the two of them mooning over the Happy Stamps catalog, while the printing press runs downstairs, ejecting bale after bale of those same trading stamps. "Great Scott," Mom says. "According to the fine print, you can get anything with Happy Stamps, Roger. You tell them what you want, and they figure out how many books you need to get it. Why, for 6 or 7 million books, we could probably get a Happy Stamps house in the suburbs." Roger discovers, however, that although the stamps are perfect, the glue is defective. If you lap the stamps and stick them in the book, they're fine, but if you send them through a mechanical licker, the pink happy stamps turn blue. At the end of the story, Roger is in the basement, standing in front of a mirror. Behind him, on the table, are roughly 90 books of happy stamps, each book filled with individually licked sheets of stamps. Our hero's lips are pink. He runs out his tongue. That's even pinker. Even his teeth are turning pink. Mom calls cheerily down the stairs, saying she has just gotten off the phone with the Happy Stamps National Redemption Center in Terre Haute, and the lady said they could probably get a nice tutor in Weston for only 11,600,000 books of Happy Stamps. "That's nice, Mom," Roger says. He looks at himself a moment longer in the mirror, lips pink and eyes bleak, then slowly returns to the table. Behind him, billions of Happy Stamps are stuffed into basement storage bins. Slowly, our hero opens a fresh stamp book, then begins to lick sheets and stick them in. Only 11,590,000 books to go, he thinks, as the story ends, and Mom can have her tutor. There were things wrong with this story. The biggest hole was probably Roger's failure simply to start over with a different glue. But it was cute. It was fairly original, and I knew I had done some pretty good writing. After a long time spent studying the markets in my beat-up Writer's Digest, I sent Happy Stamps off to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. It came back 3 weeks later with a form rejection slip attached. This slip bore Alfred Hitchcock's unmistakable profile in red ink and wished me good luck with my story. At the bottom was an unsigned jotted message, the only personal response I got from AHMM over 8 years of periodic submissions. "Don't staple manuscripts," the postscript read. "Loose pages plus paperclip equal correct way to submit copy." This was pretty cold advice, I thought, but useful in its way. I have never stapled a manuscript since. My room in our Durham house was upstairs, under the eaves. At night I could lie in bed beneath one of those eaves. If I sat up suddenly, I was apt to whack my head a good one, and read by the light of a gooseneck lamp that put an amusing boa constrictor of shadow on the ceiling. Sometimes the house was quiet, except for the whoosh of the furnace and the patter of rats in the attic. Sometimes my grandmother would spend an hour or so around midnight yelling for someone to check Dick. She was afraid he hadn't been fed. Dick, a horse she'd had in her days as a schoolteacher, was at least 40 years dead. I had a desk beneath the room's other eave, my old Royal typewriter, and 100 or so paperback books, mostly science fiction, which I had lined up along the baseboard. On my bureau was a Bible, one for memorizing verses in Methodist Youth Fellowship, and a Webcor phonograph with an automatic changer and a turntable covered in soft green velvet. On it, I played my records, mostly 45s by Elvis, Chuck Berry, Freddie Cannon, and Fats Domino. I liked Fats. He knew how to rock, and you could tell he was having fun. When I got the rejection slip from AHMM, I pounded a nail into the wall above the Webcor, wrote Happy Stamps on the rejection slip, and poked it onto the nail. Then I sat on my bed and listened to Fats sing I'm Ready. I felt pretty good, actually. When you're still too young to shave, optimism is a perfectly legitimate response to failure. By the time I was 14 and shaving twice a week, whether I needed it or not, the nail in my wall would no longer support the weight of the rejection slips impaled upon it. I replaced the nail with a spike and went on writing. By the time I was 16, I'd begun to get rejection slips with handwritten notes, a little more encouraging than the advice to stop using staples and start using paper clips. The first of these hopeful notes was from Algis Budrys, then the editor of Fantasy and Science Fiction, who read a story of mine called The Night of the Tiger. The inspiration was, I think, an episode of The Fugitive, in which Dr. Richard Kimball worked as an attendant cleaning out cages in a zoo or a circus. And Budrys wrote, "This is good. Not for us, but good. You have talent. Submit again." Those four brief sentences, scribbled by a fountain pen that left big ragged blotches in its wake, brightened the dismal winter of my 16th year. 10 years or so later, after I'd sold a couple of novels, I discovered The Night of the Tiger in a box of old manuscripts and thought it was still a perfectly respectable tale, albeit one obviously written by a guy who had only begun to learn his chops. I rewrote it and on a whim resubmitted it to FNSF. This time, they bought it. One thing I've noticed is that when you've had a little success, magazines are a lot less apt to use that phrase, "not for us." Although he was a year younger than his classmates, my big brother was bored with high school. Some of this had to do with his intellect. Dave's IQ tested in the 150s or 160s. But I think it was mostly his restless nature. For Dave, high school just wasn't super-duper enough. There was no pow, no wham, no fun. He solved the problem, at least temporarily, by creating a newspaper which he called Dave's Rag. The Rag's office was a table located in the dirt-floored, rock-walled, spider-infested confines of our basement, somewhere north of the furnace and east of the root cellar, where Clayton and Ella's endless cartons of preserves and canned vegetables were kept. The Rag was an odd combination of family newsletter and small-town bi-weekly. Sometimes it was a monthly if Dave got sidetracked by other interests, maple sugaring, cider making, rocket building, and car customizing, just to name a few. And then there would be jokes I didn't understand about how Dave's Rag was a little late this month, or how we shouldn't bother Dave because he was down in the basement, on the Rag. Jokes or no jokes, circulation rose slowly from about 5 copies per issue, sold to nearby family members, to something like 50 or 60, with our relatives and the relatives of neighbors in our small town, Durham's population in 1962 was about 900, eagerly awaiting each new edition. A typical number would let people know how Charlie Harrington's broken leg was mending, what guest speakers might be coming to the West Durham Methodist Church, how much water the King boys were hauling from the town pump to keep from draining the well behind the house. Of course, it went dry every fucking summer, no matter how much water we hauled. Who was visiting the Browns or the Halls on the other side of Methodist Corners, and whose relatives were due to hit town each summer. Dave also included sports, word games, weather reports. "It's been pretty dry, but local farmer Harold Davis says if we don't have at least one good rain in August, he will smile and kiss a pig." Recipes, a continuing story, I wrote that, and Dave's jokes and humor, which included nuggets like these. "Stan, what did the beaver say to the oak tree?" "Jan, it was nice gnawing you." First beatnik, "How do you get to Carnegie Hall?" Second beatnik, "Practice, man, practice." During the Rag's first year, the print was purple. Those issues were produced on a flat plate of jelly called a hectograph. My brother quickly decided the hectograph was a pain in the butt. It was just too slow for him. Even as a kid in short pants, Dave hated to be halted. Whenever Milt, our mom's boyfriend, sweeter than smart, Mom said to me one day a few months after she dropped him, got stuck in traffic or at a stoplight, Dave would lean over from the back seat of Milt's Buick and yell, "Drive over him, Uncle Milt! Drive over him!" As a teenager, waiting for the hectograph to freshen between pages printed, while freshening, the print would meld into a vague purple membrane which hung in the jelly like a manatee's shadow, drove Dave all but insane with impatience. Also, he badly wanted to add photographs to the newspaper. He took good ones, and by age 16 he was developing them as well. He rigged a darkroom in a closet, and from its tiny, chemical-stinking confines produced pictures which were often startling in their clarity and composition. The photo on the back of the Regulators, showing me with a copy of the magazine containing my first published story, was taken by Dave with an old Kodak and developed in his closet darkroom. In addition to these frustrations, the flats of hectograph jelly had a tendency to incubate and support colonies of strange, spore-like growths in the unsavory atmosphere of our basement, no matter how meticulous we were about covering the damned old slow-coach thing once the day's printing chores were done. What looked fairly ordinary on Monday sometimes looked like something out of an H.P. Lovecraft horror tale by the weekend. In Brunswick, where he went to high school, Dave found a shop with a small drum printing press for sale. It worked. Barely. You typed up your copy on stencils, which could be purchased in a local office supply store for 19 cents apiece. My brother called this chore cutting stencil, and it was usually my job as I was less prone to make typing errors. The stencils were attached to the drum of the press, lathered up with the world's stinkiest, oogiest ink, and then you were off to the races. Crank till your arm falls off, son. We were able to put together in 2 nights what had previously taken a week with the hectograph, and while the drum press was messy, it did not look infected with a potentially fatal disease. Dave's rag entered its brief golden age. I wasn't much interested in the printing process, and I wasn't interested at all in the arcana of first developing and then reproducing photographs. I didn't care about putting Hearst shifters in cars, making cider, or seeing if a certain formula would send a plastic rocket into the stratosphere. Usually they didn't even make it over the house. What I cared about most between 1958 and 1966 was movies. As the 50s gave way to the 60s, there were only 2 movie theaters in the area, both in Lewiston. The Empire was the first run house, showing Disney pictures, Bible epics, and musicals in which widescreen ensembles of well-scrubbed folks danced and sang. I went to these if I had a ride. A movie was a movie, after all. But I didn't like them very much. They were boringly wholesome. They were predictable. During The Parent Trap, I kept hoping Haley Mills would run into Vic Morrow from the Blackboard Jungle. That would have livened things up a little, by God. I felt that one look at Vic's switchblade knife and gimlet gaze would have put Haley's piddling domestic problems in some kind of reasonable perspective. And when I lay in bed at night, under my eave, listening to the wind in the trees or the rats in the attic, it was not Debbie Reynolds as Tammy or Sandra Dee as Gidget that I dreamed of, but Yvette Vickers from Attack of the Giant Leeches or Luana Anders from Dementia 13. Never mind sweet. Never mind uplifting. Never mind Snow White and the 7 goddamn dwarves. At 13, I wanted monsters that ate whole cities, radioactive corpses that came out of the ocean and ate surfers, and girls in black bras who looked like trailer trash. Horror movies, science fiction movies, movies about teenage gangs on the prowl, movies about losers on motorcycles. This was the stuff that turned my dials up to 10. The place to get all this was not at the Empire, on the upper end of Lisbon Street, but at the Ritz, down at the lower end, amid the pawn shops and not far from Louis Clothing, where in 1964 I bought my first pair of Beetle boots. The distance from my house to the Ritz was 14 miles, and I hitchhiked there almost every weekend during the 8 years between 1958 and 1966, when I finally got my driver's license. Sometimes I went with my friend Chris Chesley. Sometimes I went alone, but unless I was sick or something, I always went. It was at the Ritz that I saw I Married a Monster from Outer Space with Tom Tryon, The Haunting with Claire Bloom and Julie Harris, The Wild Angels with Peter Fonda and Nancy Sinatra. I saw Olivia de Havilland put out James Caan's eyes with makeshift knives in Lady in a Cage, saw Joseph Cotten come back from the dead in Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, and watched with held breath and not a little prurient interest to see if Allison Hayes would grow all the way out of her clothes in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. At the Ritz, all the finer things in life were available, or might be available, if you only sat in the 3rd row, paid close attention, and did not blink at the wrong moment. Chris and I liked just about any horror movie, but our faves were the string of American international films, most directed by Roger Corman, with titles cribbed from Edgar Allan Poe. I wouldn't say based upon the works of Edgar Allan Poe, because there is little in any of them which has anything to do with Poe's actual stories and poems. The Raven was filmed as a comedy, no kidding. And yet the best of them, The Haunted Palace, The Conqueror Worm, The Mask of the Red Death, achieved a hallucinatory eeriness that made them special. Chris and I had our own name for these films, one that made them into a separate genre. There were westerns, there were love stories, there were war stories, and then there were Poe pictures. "Want a hitch to the show Saturday afternoon?" Chris would ask. "Go to the Ritz?" "What's on?" I'd ask. "A motorcycle picture and a Poe picture," he'd say. I, of course, was on that combo like white on rice. Bruce Dern going batshit on a Harley, and Vincent Price going batshit in a haunted castle overlooking a restless ocean. Who could ask for more? You might even get Hazel Court wandering around in a lacy, low-cut nightgown, if you were lucky. Of all the Poe pictures, the one that affected Chris and me the most deeply was The Pit and The Pendulum. Written by Richard Matheson and filmed in both widescreen and Technicolor, color horror pictures were still a rarity in 1961 when this one came out. Pitt took a bunch of standard gothic ingredients and turned them into something special. It might have been the last really great studio horror picture before George Romero's ferocious indie, The Night of the Living Dead, came along and changed everything forever. In some few cases for the better, in most for the worse. The best scene, the one which froze Chris and me into our seats, depicted John Kerr digging into a castle wall and discovering the corpse of his sister, who was obviously buried alive. I have never forgotten the corpse's close-up, shot through a red filter and a distorting lens which elongated the face into a huge, silent scream. On the long hitch home that night, if rides were slow in coming, you might end up walking 4 or 5 miles and not get home until well after dark. I had a wonderful idea. I would turn The Pit and the Pendulum into a book. Would novelize it, as Monarch Books had novelized such undying film classics as Jack the Ripper, Gorgo, and Conga. But I wouldn't just write this masterpiece. I would also print it, using the drum press in our basement, and sell copies at school. Zap! Kapow! As it was conceived, so was it done. Working with the care and deliberation for which I would later be critically acclaimed, I turned out my novel version of The Pit and the Pendulum in 2 days, composing directly onto the stencils from which I'd print. Although no copies of that particular masterpiece survive, at least to my knowledge, I believe it was 8 pages long, each page single-spaced and paragraph breaks kept to an absolute minimum. Each stencil cost 19 cents, remember. I printed sheets on both sides, just as in a standard book, and added a title page on which I drew a rudimentary pendulum, dripping small black blotches, which I hoped would look like blood. At the last moment, I realized I had forgotten to identify the publishing house. After a half hour or so of pleasant mulling, I typed the words, "A VIB book," in the upper right corner of my title page. VIB stood for Very Important Book. I ran off about 40 copies of The Pit and the Pendulum, blissfully unaware that I was in violation of every plagiarism and copyright statute in the history of the world. My thoughts were focused almost entirely on how much money I might make if my story was a hit at school. The stencils had cost me $1.71. Having to use up one whole stencil for the title page seemed a hideous waste of money, but you had to look good, I'd reluctantly decided. You had to go out there with a bit of the old attitude. The paper had cost another 2 bits or so. The staples were free, cribbed from my brother. You might have to paperclip stories you were sending out to magazines, but this was a book. This was the big time. After some further thought, I priced VIB number 1, The Pit and the Pendulum, by Steve King, at $0.25 a copy. I thought I might be able to sell 10. My mother would buy 1 to get me started. She could always be counted on. And that would add up to $2.50. I'd make about 40 cents, which would be enough to finance another educational trip to the Ritz. If I sold 2 more, I could get a big sack of popcorn and a Coke as well. The Pit and the Pendulum turned out to be my first bestseller. I took the entire print run to school in my book bag. In 1961, I would have been an eighth grader at Durham's newly built four-room elementary school. And by noon that day, I had sold 24. By the end of lunch hour, when word had gotten around about the lady buried in the wall, they stared with horror at the bones sticking out from the ends of her fingers, realizing she had died scratching madly for escape. I had sold 36. I had $9 in change weighing down the bottom of my book bag, upon which Durham's answer to Daddy Cool had carefully printed most of the lyrics to The Lion Sleeps Tonight, and was walking around in a kind of dream, unable to believe my sudden ascension to previously unsuspected realms of wealth. It all seemed too good to be true. It was. When the school day ended at 2:00, I was summoned to the principal's office, where I was told I couldn't turn the school into a marketplace. Especially not, Miss Heisler said, to sell such trash as the pit and the pendulum. Her attitude didn't much surprise me. Miss Heisler had been the teacher at my previous school, the one roomer at Methodist Corners, where I went to the 5th and 6th grades. During that time, she had spied me reading a rather sensational teenage rumble novel, The Amboy Dukes by Irving Shulman, and had taken it away. This was just more of the same, and I was disgusted with myself for not seeing the outcome in advance. In those days, we called someone who did an idiotic thing a dubber, pronounced dubba, if you were from Maine. I had just dubbed up big time. "What I don't understand, Stevie," she said, "is why you'd write junk like this in the first place. You're talented. Why do you want to waste your abilities?" She had rolled up a copy of VIB No. 1 and was brandishing it at me, the way a person might brandish a rolled-up newspaper at a dog that had piddled on the rug. She waited for me to answer. To her credit, the question was not entirely rhetorical. But I had no answer to give. I was ashamed. I have spent a good many years since, too many, I think, being ashamed about what I write. I think I was 40 before I realized that almost every writer of fiction and poetry who has ever published a line has been accused by someone of wasting his or her God-given talent. If you write, or paint, or dance, or sculpt, or sing, I suppose, someone will try to make you feel lousy about it, that's all. I'm not editorializing, just trying to give you the facts as I see them. Miss Heisler told me I would have to give everyone's money back. I did so with no argument, even to those kids, and there were quite a few, I'm happy to say, who insisted on keeping their copies of VIB No. 1. I ended up losing money on the deal after all, but when summer vacation came, I printed 4 dozen copies of a new story, an original called The Invasion of the Star Creatures, and sold all but 4 or 5. I guess that means I won in the end, at least in a financial sense. But in my heart, I stayed ashamed. I kept hearing Miss Heisler ask why I wanted to waste my talent, why I wanted to waste my time, why I wanted to write junk. Doing a serial story for Dave's Rag was fun, but my other journalistic duties bored me. Still, I had worked for a newspaper of sorts. Word got around, and during my sophomore year at Lisbon High, I became editor of our school newspaper, The Drum. I don't recall being given any choice in this matter. I think I was simply appointed. My second-in-command, Danny Eamon, had even less interest in the paper than I did. Danny just liked the idea that room 4, where we did our work, was near the girls' bathroom. "Someday I'll just go crazy and hack my way in there, Steve," he told me on more than one occasion. "Hack, hack, hack." Once, he added, perhaps in an effort to justify himself, "the prettiest girls in school pull up their skirts in there." This struck me as so fundamentally stupid it might actually be wise, like a Zen koan or an early story by John Updike. The Drum did not prosper under my editorship. Then, as now, I tend to go through periods of idleness followed by periods of workaholic frenzy. In the school year 1963-1964, The Drum published just one issue, but that one was a monster thicker than the Lisbon Falls telephone book. One night, sick to death of class reports, cheerleading updates, and some lame brain's efforts to write a school poem, I created a satiric high school newspaper of my own when I should have been captioning photographs for the Drum. What resulted was a foresheet which I called The Village Vomit. The boxed motto in the upper left-hand corner was not all the news that's fit to print, but all the shit that will stick. That piece of dimwit humor got me into the only real trouble of my high school career. It also led me to the most useful writing lesson I ever got. In typical Mad Magazine style, what, me worry? I filled the vomit with fictional tidbits about the LHS faculty using teacher nicknames the student body would immediately recognize. Thus, Miss Raypack, the study hall monitor, became Miss Ratpack. Mr. Ricker, the college track English teacher and the school's most urbane faculty member, he looked quite a bit like Craig Stevens in Peter Gunn, became Cowman because his family owned Ricker Dairy. Mr. Deal, the earth science teacher, became Old Raw Deal. As all sophomoric humorists must be, I was totally blown away by my own wit. What a funny fellow I was. A regular Milltown H.L. Mencken. I simply must take the vomit to school and show all my friends. They would bust a collective gut. As a matter of fact, they did bust a collective gut. I had some good ideas about what tickled the funny bones of high school kids, and most of them were showcased in The Village Vomit. In one article, Cowman's prize jersey won a livestock farting contest at Topsom Fair. In another, Old Raw Deal was fired for sticking the eyeballs of specimen fetal pigs up his nostrils. Humor in the grand Swiftian manner, you see. Pretty sophisticated, eh? During period four, three of my friends were laughing so hard in the back of study hall that Miss Raypack, Rat Pack to you, chum, crept up on them to see what was so funny. She confiscated the village vomit on which I had, either out of overweening pride or almost unbelievable naivete, put my name as editor-in-chief and grand high poobah. And at the close of school, I was for the second time in my student career summoned to the office on account of something I had written. This time, the trouble was a good deal more serious. Most of the teachers were inclined to be good sports about my teasing. Even Old Raw Deal was willing to let bygones be bygones concerning the pig's eyeballs. But one was not. This was Miss Margotin, who taught shorthand and typing to the girls in the business courses. She commanded both respect and fear. In the tradition of teachers from an earlier era, Miss Margotin did not want to be your pal, your psychologist, or your inspiration. She was there to teach business skills, and she wanted all learning to be done by the rules, her rules. Girls in Miss Margotin's classes were sometimes asked to kneel on the floor, and if the hems of their skirts didn't touch the linoleum, they were sent home to change. No amount of tearful begging could soften her. No reasoning could modify her view of the world. Her detention lists were the longest of any teacher in the school, but her girls were routinely selected as valedictorians or salutatorians and usually went on to good jobs. Many came to love her. Others loathed her then and likely still do now, all these years later. These latter girls called her Maggot Margotin, as, no doubt, their mothers had before them. And in The Village Vomit, I had an item which began, Miss Margotin, known affectionately to Lisbonians everywhere as Maggot. Mr. Higgins, our bald principal, breezily referred to in The Vomit as Old Cue Ball, told me that Miss Margotin had been very hurt and very upset by what I had written. She was apparently not too hurt to remember that old scriptural admonition which goes, "Vengeance is mine," saith the shorthand teacher, however. Mr. Higgins said she wanted me suspended from school. In my character, a kind of wildness and a deep conservatism are wound together like hair in a braid. It was the crazy part of me that had first written The Village Vomit and then carried it to school. Now that troublesome Mr. Hyde had dubbed up and slunk out the back door, Dr. Jekyll was left to consider how my mom would look at me if she found out I had been suspended, her hurt eyes. I had to put thoughts of her out of my mind, and fast. I was a sophomore. I was a year older than most others in my class, and at 6'2", I was one of the bigger boys in school. I desperately didn't want to cry in Mr. Higgins's office, not with kids surging through the halls and looking curiously in the window at us, Mr. Higgins behind his desk, me in the bad boy seat. In the end, Miss Margotin settled for a formal apology and 2 weeks of detention for the bad boy who had dared call her maggot in print. It was bad, but what in high school is not? At the time we're stuck in it, like hostages locked in a Turkish bath, high school seems the most serious business in the world to just about all of us. It's not until the second or third class reunion that we start realizing how absurd the whole thing was. A day or two later, I was ushered into Mr. Higgins's office and made to stand in front of her. Miss Margotin sat ramrod straight, with her arthritic hands folded in her lap and her gray eyes fixed unflinchingly on my face, and I realized that something about her was different from any other adult I had ever met. I didn't pinpoint that difference at once, but I knew that there would be no charming this lady, no winning her over. Later, while I was flying paper planes with the other bad boys and bad girls in detention hall, detention turned out not to be so bad, I decided that it was pretty simple. Miss Margotin didn't like boys. She was the first woman I ever met in my life who didn't like boys, not even one little bit. If it makes any difference, my apology was heartfelt. Miss Margotin really had been hurt by what I wrote, and that much I could understand. I doubt that she hated me. She was probably too busy. But she was the National Honor Society advisor at LHS, and when my name showed up on the candidate list 2 years later, she vetoed me. The Honor Society did not need boys of his type, she said. I have come to believe she was right. A boy who once wiped his ass with poison ivy probably doesn't belong in a smart people's club. I haven't trucked much with satire since then.